This podcast is a recording of a workers' solidarity movement discussion about Paul Mason's recently published book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere. The speaker is Andrew Flood, who will be publishing a major review of this text at www.wsm.ie. For the purpose of this discussion, he focused in on Mason's presentation of a networked individual.
The book of Paul Mason's Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere was published, I think, back in December. And it's interesting for a number of reasons. One is the actual speed of publication, because he actually was finishing it off when Occupy Wall Street started to spread out all over the States, which I think was just after the demonstration. Loads of people had been arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge, which I think was late September or October, so quite a fast publication cycle. Word for word, it's by far the best writing I've read on the crisis so far, and on resistance to it. Every chapter tends to contain at least one "why didn't I think of that" moment. And the effect is all the more powerful because it's also written in an easy-to-read journalistic style. I read it cover to cover in about 24 hours, so that's unusual enough for books. Right from the first page of the introduction, anyone who's been involved with the emerging movements of the last decade will recognise their own experience being reflected back in it. Mason's descriptions of the people, events and locations of resistance read as those of an insightful insider. Which is not to say he never gets things wrong, or that I'd entirely agree with his perspective. I mean, he's quite interesting. For people who don't know him, he's the economics correspondent for Newsnight, which is the BBC Two kind of flagship heavy news programme. And previously he was an activist in the Trotskyist Workers' Power Group, probably a good few years back at this stage, which has obviously given him some insight into understanding how the radical left and activist movements work, and you know who to talk to and that sort of thing. That comes across in his reporting a lot. And although the book itself is in many ways a break with orthodox Marxist politics, but in part it's incomplete, and you can see some of his old political legacy coming in. I'm not going to try and summarise the whole thing. I'm actually writing a long review that's going to do that, and that's at about 8,000 words, but you'd be stuck here for an hour if I went through that. So I'm pulling out what I think are three or four of the most interesting things. The chapter no one saw it coming, the second chapter, is a reminder of how recent the kind of new emerging world we're in actually is. And Mason points out that no significant mainstream source saw the Arab revolts brewing in 2011. You know, like he looks at, you know, Time magazine, The Economist, all that, what they're writing in late 2010, and it's just not there at all. And in fact, the other interesting thing is, even as it starts to happen, they're all writing about how this can't spread. This is, you know, just going to be one location. It's not going to go anywhere else. They saw that as being impossible, the actual spread. At the same time, you had the... It was part of that whole thing, like the idea that, you know, the triumph of Western capitalism, basically, that, you know, ran from the period when the Berlin Wall came down, really until the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and I'll get onto that in a moment. And so you had slogans like, you know, that we'd reached the end of history, or that there is no alternative, which was the famous Thatcherite one. And Mason says that that capitalist triumph worldview, in which everybody believed in, particularly the left, came to an end with the collapse of Lehman Brothers, when suddenly it became possible to imagine the collapse of capitalism. And he's riffing off, I don't know who the original guy who came up with the phrase was, but I think it was somebody in the French left who said, you know, we were in a period where it was more possible to imagine the end of the world than it was the collapse of capitalism. But Lehman Brothers sort of ended that, because suddenly capitalism didn't look so all-powerful after all. In the social roots of the new unrest, he moves towards putting forward a general theory to answer the question in the book's title, that is, why is it kicking off everywhere? Why in 2011? Where did all this come from? And he puts what he calls the graduate with no future at the centre of this story, citing youth unemployment rates from Libya to Spain to Britain. And that's because one of the things that happened as the crisis developed was it suddenly became clear to all these students who had been fed into the university system on, you know, a very increased neoliberal form, on the expectation of careers at the other end, that those careers simply no longer existed anymore, that they were being trained for something that wouldn't be there when they came out. It's also interesting because he kind of makes a break with the more traditional leftist students or middle class type cliches, and he outlines what the modern student actually is. The free time is minimal, precarious part-time jobs are essential to their existence, and they've become a vital asset for the financial system. In 2006 alone, Citicorp alone made $220 million clear profit from the student loan books. In Chapter 7, he moves on to explore the specific economic circumstances that have given rise to these new movements. And it's both a quick summary of the causes of the current crisis, but also at the look at the way neoliberalism has driven down wages and working conditions for many. I'm not going to go into that because it's familiar enough. But he then returns to the causes of the Arab Spring, and as well as highlighting the high youth unemployment rate, goes on to sketch how US quantitative easing had the effect of causing massive hikes in food prices. The quantitative easing was when the Fed started printing vast amounts of dollars, which had the effect of devaluing the US dollar against other currencies and pushing up prices globally. And because of the special position of the dollar as the world currency reckoning, one of the effects this had was prices outside of the US on food in Egypt, for instance, increased by 19%. Now, that made a big difference if you were one of those people who was living on $2 a day, because in effect it turned acceptable poverty, in inverted commas, into utter destitution. So that helps explain why the risings happened in 2011 specifically, rather than at some other point in the previous decade. But it's also important to understand that the reduced standard of living is probably a permanent rather than a temporary feature for almost all of us on the planet. You know, the idea, and again, this isn't original, that the current generation are probably going to be one of the first generations in a while that will be significantly poorer than their parents were. He predicts that from California to Cairo, it is certain that the rising generation will be materially poorer than those that came before them. Even if we do not have deflationary slump 1930s style, countries like Greece will experience 1930s levels of austerity. And of course, that's already happening in Greece when you look at the figures. Ireland perhaps isn't that far behind it. And he ends that chapter with a warning that actually I think is pretty interesting, because it makes clear that we're not just talking about economics here. One of the themes that he's going to bring in, and I'll talk about in a minute, is individual freedom. So he says any repeat of the 1930s economically could provoke a culture war just as bitter as the one that turned Berlin from a tolerant jazz age metropolis into a racially pure Weigerian wasteland in the space of 5 years. And, you know, it's one of the scary things about the history of the 30s, is particularly if you think about Berlin, you know, Germany in general to a certain extent, what happened culturally there in terms of, you know, individual freedom being wiped out in a very short space of time. In the last global wave, he moves on to look at the revolutions of 1848, which he says have particular relevance to today for two reasons. Now, the first is the role played by that group he identified earlier as the graduate with no future. That group also existed in 1848 and also been created by an economic crisis in the 1840s. But secondly, and more importantly, because the aftermath of the initially successful revolts in 1848 was once the demand for democracy started to make progress, if the workers began to fight for social justice, businessmen and radical journalists who had led the fight for democracy turned against them, rebuilding the old dictatorial forms of repression to put them down. Conversely, where the working class was weak and honest, the radical middle classes would die in the barricades, often committed to a left-wing program themselves. I mean, one of the obvious comparisons today with that is what's happening in Egypt at the moment, and the shift of the revolution and the army coming back into power. Unlike 1848, however, he says there's no coherent mainstream left. Now, that's a really interesting idea, to say 1848 coherent left. Today, there isn't. You know, like at first it seems quite counterintuitive. But he's really talking about the mainstream. And he says the problem for the mainstream left is there's three parts to it. One, free market capitalism has failed. Secondly, there's a wave of resistance to wage cuts and austerity. And thirdly, the political leaders of social democracy cannot accept points one and two. They're still trying to come up with something that contains those. But he sees an advantage in the lack of currency in the left in that it undermines the rationale for a democratic counter-revolution of the type that was seen in June 1848. And in a way, I think the relatively low level of response to, say, Occupy, for instance. I mean, yeah, okay, the stuff on the television in the States looks pretty brutal. Some of the stuff in Europe does. But given the actual size of some of those movements of protest, the level of repression has been relatively low. It's partly because there just isn't a threat. There isn't a Red Scare in the States. You know, this isn't the 1950s. You don't have, you know, a Communist Party that can be blamed for hiding behind everything. All that kind of more conventional end, which is quite interesting. But the really interesting stuff, I think, in the book is actually the stuff about networks. And this is really the centre of the book, and it's the idea of the transforming effect of modern technology, the internet and mobile phones, and in particular in creating what Mason refers to as the networked individual. He starts the discussion with an explanation of the network effect, and this is basically the principle that the more people that use a network, the more useful it is. Simply, if you're the first person in the world with a telephone, it's actually not a hell of a lot of use, and even when there's two people with phones, it's not that much use. But when everybody has them, it suddenly becomes extremely useful. And that's the reason why so many of us are stuck using Facebook, even though we might dislike its corporate greed, unethical methods, and use by the police and other state forces as a surveillance tool. Almost all of us make the judgment that these disadvantages, all of which are significant, are outweighed by the advantage of not only being able to reach out to hundreds of similar activists, but also thousands or even hundreds of thousands of random folk. Even if in reality, only at those times when we really have something to say that is of interest. And just to illustrate that, like one of my experiences during the year was when it was being part of the Shelter Scene Media Group that took part in the breaking of the story in the Irish media about the police Dan Cobb joking about threatening to rape women in their custody. State media actually initially refused to broadcast the tape at all. They had it for 24 hours. They didn't use it. But using Facebook and Twitter, the recording we put online was listened to by about 70,000 people within about 48 hours. And it took the state media to finally broadcast it after that had started happening. An article I'd written on it for the WSM site explaining what had happened was shared by over 2,000 people on Facebook in the same time period, and I think about 20,000 people read it. Now, that's a genuinely new development in communications made possible by hundreds or even thousands of other people making small and low-commitment decisions to click share or retweet on an item in their feed. And that reason that's significant is if you compare this to a pre-internet situation where you wanted to do the same thing, right? You'd have to actually physically print 2,000 copies of the thing. You'd then have to find people willing to distribute them. And even physically, this isn't a small task. That's about 8 of those boxes we use for worker solidarity work. And you could probably guess that it would take about 60 hours minimum to actually hand them out. So it's an entirely different sort of process. The internet also allows the actual form of protests to organise to rapidly change in an organic fashion. If you think of the recent kind of revolts and uprisings, Twitter was the big one everyone was talking about for Iran, Facebook for Egypt, and of course BlackBerry phones for the August riots in London. And that's not because in each of those different cases somebody centrally set those as the key tools for the organisation of each role. They were simply the tools people used. Now, that's not to prevent all these events as somehow spontaneous. At least for the North African examples, there are well-documented examples of relatively small numbers of activists preparing the ground. And these are the people a good bit of the book is actually about. But while they might have planned the actual reach, the actual reach they achieved through social media was spontaneous. And again, the difference is you can decide to print 20,000 leaflets and arrange for 100 people to hand them out, but you can't decide or arrange to have 2,000 people share or retweet something, or 10,000 or 50,000. Mason actually sees power relations being eroded in a fundamental way by this new world. The network, in short, has begun to erode power relationships, I'm quoting here, we've come to believe were permanent features of capitalism. The helplessness of the consumer, the military-style hierarchy of boss and underlings at work, the power of mainstream media empires to shape ideology, the repressive capabilities of the state, and the inevitability of monopolisation by large companies. So that's a pretty big claim, actually, to see all those being undermined. He argues that the use of social networks substitutes for the strong ties that used to exist among workers, and really that the left kind of models itself on, who worked in the same factory or down the same mine. The ties generated by networks are very much weaker. They require very little commitment. If you lived in a pit village and the mine was on strike, it would be a big deal not to be on strike. But they also have a much greater reach. Again, if you're in that pit village, you'd know the other people in the village. You wouldn't necessarily know that much happening outside it. Mason argues against the standard left assertion that hierarchy is needed to defeat hierarchy. One of the examples he points to is that now infamous US military exercise where the US fleet was defeated in theory by a swarm of small Iranian boats, and they responded by kind of essentially sacking the US officer that was running the thing and starting it again with all the ships refloated. More fundamentally, he suggests that the network protest has a better chance of achieving its basic goals because it is congruent with the economic and technological conditions of modern society. This gets most interesting in Chapter 7, where he talks about this networked individual. He opens by showing how individual freedoms that were won in the period from the late 1960s were not, in fact, unique in history. I think it's a common mistake we sort of make is so we see history as moving forward and things are slowly getting better and, you know, retreats don't really happen. You know, I already mentioned the specifics of Berlin under the Nazis and that whole period of the 30s, but he's talking about here the period before World War I. And it's, quote, zeitgeist of globalized trade, technological progress, and sexual liberation. A false start, followed by a century of economic crisis, militarism, genocide, and totalitarian rule. I mean, rule that came apart in 1914. And in a way, this is one of the sections where he's most clearly breaking with old left orthodoxy, and at least to an extent even with some of his own previous writings. He refers to the movements of the 60s and the 1962 Port Huron statements, which was one put together by a gang of radical students, basically. And he rejects the idea that this break with collectivism, because this was all about individual freedom, this is where this started to emerge from that movement in the 60s, was the doomed precursor of neoliberalism, which is a common way the left sees it. I mean, if people remember the May Day 2004 protest here and the kind of, you know, the kind of discussions that are happening about diversity of tactics and the way we handled the march on Farmleigh. And one of the funny things that happened the next day is the SWP turned up with a leaflet accusing us all of being Thatcher's children because that had been our approach rather than to have a single collective line. And then kind of whatever happened, they suppressed the leaflet quite quickly afterwards, possibly with somebody's hasty decision. But that was a common enough left outlook to this. But he sees that pre-1914 one and the 1960s on similar thing as being premature because technology was not developed enough to allow freedom for the majority, and premature because the forces of collectivism, nationalism, and corporate power were at that point in time stronger than the forces fighting against them. Here he's going much further than pointing out that technology allows for faster, more widespread dissemination of ideas, which is what I talked about earlier. He's arguing that this is changing the way we actually function, that it's changing what people are. Mason argues that these possibilities are now open because technology has allowed the development of the networked individual, whose use of the internet and smartphones has resulted in profound impacts on individual behaviour and even consciousness. So that by 2003, web use had begun to produce new attitudes and behaviour away from the computer. The standard objection to this line of argument tends to be that only a narrow layer of the population have access to this sort of technology. So throughout the book, he's sprinkling in counterexamples of, you know, computers being used in slums in Cairo or in the Philippines, or how the spread of cheap Chinese mobile phones has had a huge impact on Maasai culture in Kenya. But it's also the case, and particularly for those of us who have been using technology for a while, to forget about quite how quickly it's now spreading into every aspect of life. And actually, one statistic in the book that really struck me, to the extent I actually posted it on Facebook when I saw it, was Facebook put on 6/7 of its user base in the 3 years after Lehman's Brothers went bust. So to all of us, Lehman's Brothers going bust is a really recent thing that happened, right? But since that happened, Facebook is now, 700% bigger than it was on the day that happened. So if you think about the amount of extra people being brought into networks through that, that's enormous. It's particularly relevant to me because I've been doing stuff online since the 1990s, so I still have the mindset where it's a handful of geeks and colleges who've discovered this thing and nobody else knows about it. The argument he's making here is not trivial. It is that these technologies are actually transforming people. In an interview with Alternet after the publication of the book, he wrote, "Who knows whether there's anything neurological, but certainly behaviourally, people are exhibiting a greater propensity to behave in a networked way." And in the book, there's a bit where he launches into a description of how multi-user online computer games transform people and how the transformation has moved back into the real world. Quote, "A woman tweeting at work or from the front line of a demonstration is experiencing the same shared consciousness, role play, multifaceted personality, and intense bonding that you would get in World of Warcraft." I suspect at this stage the room's going to divide to some extent into two groups, one of whom will go, "I sort of get that," and the other will go, "What? I don't know what any of that even means." Later in the chapter, he returns to the theme saying, "Observers of the early factory system described how within a generation it had wrought a total change in the behaviour, thinking, body shapes, and life expectancy of those imprisoned within it. People grew smaller, their limbs became bent, physical movements became more regimented, family units broke down. Why should a revolution in knowledge and technology not be producing an equally frantic, albeit diametrically opposite, change in human behaviour?" What if, he wonders, instead of waiting for the collapse of capitalism, the emancipated human being were beginning to emerge spontaneously from within the breakdown of the old order? And this just after acting, what if the most advanced form of capitalism is, in fact, this emerging semi-communal form of capitalism, exemplified by open source software and based on collaboration, management-free enterprise, profit-free projects, and open access to information? The conclusion of this chapter is worth quoting for the blend of optimism and fear that it offers, and I'm just about at the end here. He says, "I cannot help believing that in the revolutions of 2011, we began to see the human archetypes that would shape the 21st century. They effortlessly multitask. They are ironic, androgynous sometimes, seemingly engrossed in their bubble of music, but they are sometimes prepared to sacrifice their lives and freedom for the future. By the middle of the second decade of this century, it will be clear whether that is enough, whether hope, solidarity, and ironic slogans can prevail against austerity, nationalism, and religious fundamentalism. Right now, the future hangs in the balance." It's not actually the last paragraph of the book, but it would have made quite a good last paragraph. There are loads of minor insights throughout the text that I don't have time to mention here. But in my opinion, it's this question of what impact the networked individual have on a revolutionary project that's key. If correct, it's an argument for a further transformation of how we view revolutionary organisation and how we view the interaction between the revolutionary organisation and the mass of population. But it's basically an argument that the methodology that has been common to the left and also to an extent to the Republican movement in Ireland and internationally for the last century is probably not only past its sell-by date, but it is now completely missing the point. So anyway, yeah, as I said at the beginning, it's very easy to read. It's fairly cheap, and you'll read it in 24 hours, and it's full of stuff. You'll go, oh, that's really interesting. Whether it's right or wrong is a more complicated thing, and hopefully we'll get some opinions on that now.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Any questions or comments? Thank you. Yeah, we won't act you tall. We're just Mark
Well, that's not this enough. The first 140 characters.
Questions, comments? Okay, I'll kick it off then. Yeah, there's definite. I mean, shades of the old vulgar Marxist technological determinism going on there. I found a little bit. It's interesting because in some sense, some of those themes that he's talking about, people from the post-autonomous, the Italian autonomous Marxists have been talking about since the 1980s, this whole immaterial worker and networked autonomy and all that sort of stuff. And a guy called Nick Dyer Witherford wrote a book called Cyber Marx, again about, must be over 10 years ago now, again about that sort of idea of Their take on it is a little more subtle, if you like, because they're coming from the Upper East background, where they criticise technology as a weapon in the class war that sort of bosses use against workers, but also as something that could be reappropriated and turned against the bosses as well. So Nick's book on cyber Marx is basically saying this sort of network specialisation, which allows companies to break down these big sort of production units into sort of networked sort of small shops where people have much less control over the whole production thing thanks to the information structure, but then says we can turn that around and you know, ordinary workers can make use of it as well. So I'd be interested, I haven't read the book myself, I'd be interested to read it and see, sort of put it into encounter with next book there. Having said that, I think you need to limit it from, I've been spending a lot of time knocking on doors recently, talking to people about the household tax and stuff, and you can generally tell when someone answers the door whether or not, when you ask them at the end, whether you can get an email off them, etc., whether or not they have an email, and there's actually a surprising number of people that still don't have an email. So, you know, most people above a certain age, you know, the majority of them still don't have email and so on. So it's very, because everybody probably that we know has email and Facebook, etc., and the fact that Facebook is now getting up to nearly 1 billion, which is like 1 out of 7 of humanity, it's easy to think that, like, you know, everyone is involved in a city like Dublin, but it's still not the case. It's still not the case. The majority of people in Dublin, certainly in ordinary inner city areas, are actually that connected. So it's something to be borne in mind. Mark?
I think quite interesting ideas there. I think one of the key kind of phrase for me there was the no one saw it coming, and to kind of look at where we are now here in Ireland. I mean, despite obviously this kind of an upsurge in activity on the left, and there's more people getting involved in things like the household tax, but I think in their heart of hearts most people don't really see anything coming, because you know, when you've gone through years of, you know, low activity and some of like the terrible years for people like us on the left when people had money.
Things are so bad.
You kind of find it hard to believe that things will actually kick off. And I think that's why it's really important that we do something that didn't really happen in a lot of those countries before it actually kicks off, and that's have like coherent organisations that are capable of taking that kind of revolutionary energy and structuring it before it kicks off. And I think that's kind of leads into the whole technology thing and why I don't particularly agree with what he says in that sense, because he's kind of posing it as if it's one or the other. I haven't read the book either, just from listening to your lead after. And it really isn't. The two things are complementary. I mean, in my opinion, there's really no substitute for, you know, that face-to-face organising. Paul mentioned that when you speak to somebody on the door. Because the stuff you do digitally is kind of more like leafleting. It people might read it and people might agree with the message, but they don't necessarily get involved in stuff until they see somebody. They have like some point of reference as to who's doing this. And like I found that on the doors the week before last in Stony Batter when one woman says, "Oh, I'm really interested in getting active in the campaign, but I was waiting for somebody to knock on my door." Because people just don't go and take the initiative and go to meetings and just go, right, I'm going to go and meet a lot of people that have no idea who they are. So I think the organising aspect, I think, does need to have that kind of, you know, physical, real physical aspect. Whereas the digital thing is more, I mean, there's two things, two aspects as far as I'm concerned, in preparing ground for a revolutionary situation, and that's organising. The other thing is counter-hegemony, and that's for me where the digital thing comes in. It's about spreading ideas, but I don't think you can really organise that way unless you have done the actual groundwork first, and then you can use it to obviously organise, to keep organising the people that you've already organised on that, you know, one-to-one level. And I think that's all we've got there.
And Daryl.
Well, one of the things, I know I said I like that, but I think that's one of the things that I find is that there's, through Facebook and all the rest of it, is that there's no absence of understanding of how capitalism works or how nasty it is. I mean, I think that knowledge is out there and it's shared all the time. And I've got a lot of friends who I would deem as being quite intelligent and up to date with things, and would see all these articles and then indeed share articles with me, but I don't see them actually being involved in any type of action. So I think there's a big difference between and the action around what happened in the Arab Spring. And I think if people are prepared to go out and face down the military in a situation like that, I don't think people will do it because they read a couple of articles on Facebook. They're going to do it because they've actually built up a relationship of trust with comrades and obviously feel really strongly about something like that. So there's got to be something else to it besides that. And I think that the network thing has made it really easy for us to share information, and it's probably in the process of transforming society on that basis in terms of the democratic sharing of information. But I don't know if it's actually going to be the thing that will lead to action, you know what I mean? That's the crucial thing.
That bring market.
Yeah, it's a couple of things. I finished reading the book myself. I don't think that Mason's coming from a technological determinist point of view. I think he's trying to make sense of stuff that's actually happened in a way. And a key point that about his description of the educated youth without the future, I think needs to be disentangled a bit as well. It's like, so what does he actually mean by being educated? He's not talking about people who've just gone through college and have a degree. He's talking about people that have a critical capacity to think about the world around them and to make sense of the world around them in ways that speak to what Mark's talking about, counter-hegemony and counter-power, so that people's ability to understand their own circumstances is in direct conflict with the official explanations of why these circumstances exist in the first place. And I think technology is a tremendous enabler of the movement of ideas, essentially, this idea of memes, one that I'm not totally comfortable with, but certainly the ability for people to share critiques, fairly radical critiques, in ways that wasn't possible 20 years ago. And for people to make sense of particular sites of struggle within immediately in different parts of the world. That speaks to this idea that there is no other alternative. I think that's one of the key aspects of it for me. And that's where I think it's kind of useful in the sense of, like, literacy is kind of key. I think there's like Freirean kind of take on sort of having an ability to read and write is your first sort of sense of being able to make a sort of coherent sense of the world around you. And I think in terms of people having a kind of an increased political and economic literacy in terms of like how political organisations are run, how the electoral representation falls down, or having a deeper nuance and understanding of how media operates, which to a large degree was very particular in North Africa, where you had the sort of authoritarian regimes in Tunisia and Egypt. So people weren't able to use those media structures, the official media structures, they used their kind of own, and this is what that technology kind of enabled a bit as well. So I don't think he's saying that this is as a result of technology. It's always about humans, it's always about activists actually as well. It's about how they deploy this kind of stuff in some senses. But there is something fundamentally different where people in struggle are able to communicate with each other very directly and find the commonalities in their struggles whilst maintaining the very localised and kind of specific cultural and economic effects of what's going on there. That's I think significantly and quantitatively different than stuff that's happened before. What that means for us in Ireland, I think, is a different kind of thing. I can tease that out, but I'm just to argue against the technological trend and stuff.
Yeah, any more? Aileen and then Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking only recently, I grew up in a ski room. I had to leave and go to college before I met somebody who was pro-choice, before I met Anarchists, Anarchist books, we had to go to London and buy the books during the summer holidays and bring them back to Ireland to read them. So it's huge, I mean, it's an enormous change. And in terms of what you think of, how does society change? You have to have a critique of capitalism, how society is, and you have to have a sense of your own power. But the internet does give you that critique and a sense that you're not alone. It doesn't necessarily give you the sense of your own power, but I think once change happens, technology can also be used to give that sense of power. Because I remember following the tweets around the Egyptian uprising, and in the early days, a lot of the people who were involved, and I don't know, but I just followed their tweets on the ground, they were tweeting things about how isolated they were. You know, the national media is against us and people are against us, and you kind of knew where they were coming from. They didn't feel the sense. But then as things started to change and more people did become involved, then that whole changed. So in a way, technology has a magnifying effect that it can, I don't think you can replace that sense of power you get from face-to-face interaction. But once that happens, once the ball starts rolling, I think technology can magnify things so they happen much faster than they might have done in the past.
Great.
I think quite clearly the technology and the development in technology via Facebook, Twitter, etc. is huge. I mean, the ability to get ideas out there, the ability to talk to people, the ability to share information, it's transformed completely. It is interesting. I mean, I think the point that Paul made is quite important as well, that there are a certain age group where people, like the majority of people over 55 or 60, still are not online or not using email.
Unless
think people are using Skype if they have family living abroad, and so there's all sorts of ways in which things are developing. But I think what's important for us to really remember is that it's a tool, and it's possible to use that tool for good or for evil, if you like. Do you know what I mean? It's possible to use the technology. I mean, there's examples within the household tax campaign, for example, of sort of saying that instead of actually the organisers of the campaign having organisers' meetings, they're doing stuff by email lists, which, you know, is a great way for, you know, the loudest person in the room to shout loudest, because at least if there's 10 people sitting in a room, everyone have, to some extent, have equal say in the conversation. If there's 10 people involved in an email conversation, it's whoever has most time sitting at their computer or whoever happens to have a job that allows them to do that, that contributes more to that discussion, I think. So I think what's important is the motivation, if you like, behind the use of it, and that, you know, that, yeah, absolutely, as a tool for liberation and for spreading of ideas and for spreading of the ideas of individual freedom and the ideas of democracy, etc. The tool is huge, but equally, if someone wants to use it for, you know, mucking up democracy, for making it more difficult to make decisions, that's there as well. And there is also very much the danger that, well, a lot of people become consumers. An awful lot of people would say, I mean, look at, for example, any protest or meeting, however, that goes up on Facebook, and the number of people who say, yeah, I'll be there. I have no intention of ever getting up from their computer and going to the meeting or going to the protest, but it's a way of expressing it. I mean, on one hand, it's a way of expressing solidarity with the thing. So, I mean, it's not completely sort of to laugh at, because people are sort of saying, well, yeah, you know, I like the ideas. But it is like the person who's standing in their house or sitting in their house waiting for someone to knock on their door to join the anti-household tax campaign. It's sort of like, well, I'll sit here at the computer, and if someone puts up something I like, I'd say, that's good, cool. But I don't particularly want to actually have to move to putting up my own thoughts or moving inside of. But that's nothing, I mean, that's to do with where society is at and where ideas are at and how the tool is used more so than anything else.
Just two things. I really wouldn't underestimate what Gregor said about our generation having no interaction. I don't think for our children, like, just judging on household tax stuff, where a really significant section of that campaign in rural areas is that generation older than 55, and people don't even have emails, let alone understand, like, this all happens. So I do think that has to be borne in mind. The other thing I would say is that, like, a really important part, sorry I was out of the room for a bit, but it's already covered, is organisational skills. And, like, even though this stuff is going to transform a lot of the way things happen, if you look at the way previous, I'm not sure we can escape one thing that, like, it took the previous movements to get to that critical point, was years of actually trying stuff in the real world. Like, I'm not taking away when I say the real world, but I'm saying this all aids face to face. Like, it should be aimed at aiding communication, and it always takes a generation, I think, to experience a level of political struggle. And I just think, I'm not sure that, I think this can help it. I think people will obviously get more experience at using social media, but I do think a problem that we face today is that there's been 20 years of almost no political struggle, and there's a massive loss of that knowledge. And I'm not sure, I think that has to be remembered in tandem to all this, that I'm not sure social media or the just technological revolution can jump that chasm that we still face, that like there's a lot, like just trying to get things like the household tax campaign going in some areas where there's just no political experience whatsoever has proven really, really, really difficult. And it's just because people don't know like the very simple things about how you start something. So I think we have to bear that process in mind, that it's not going to, but I think it can help that. And I think as well, people would get more adept at maybe some of the stuff that Gregor's talking about, that people just like stuff on Facebook or whatever, ways of moving that, of moving people beyond that, what that is, I don't know, but I'm just saying it is a everything that comes, it takes, I think, a generation of people to try things, fail, or maybe not win outright before that can happen.
Anybody else? I know you're waiting to come back in, Andrew, but anybody else got anything? Okay, I'll abuse my position slightly by putting on one more comment in before I hand over back to Andrew. One word, statute.
What?
Statute. Those emails.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to pay the household tax because it's a statute and statutes
blah, blah, blah.
And my point about that is, yes, it's a wonderful tool for circulating stuff, but it can also be used to circulate conspiraloon shit like that fucking statute book. And also, I'm sure a lot of people here at one time or another spent time down Occupy Dane Street and found, guess what, there's a lot of people that lap all that conspiracy theory up as well. So it's the freedom of circulation of information does not necessarily mean that it's good information. And I'll shut up. I lost my word, I'll shut up. Sorry, Mark.
And just very briefly, when you were there speaking, as well as false information getting out, if you're not careful, you can leak internal bulletins to other people in the left. So you have to watch that as well.
Any more? Okay, I'll hand over to Andrew to wrap up.
Okay, so probably a good starting point would be to say that this, I knocked this down from an 8,000 word summary I'd written of the book to write a review to 2,000 words on it. So part of that process was picking out the stuff that would be more meat to actually discuss, the more theoretical stuff. A lot of the points people have been raised, the actual structure of the book sort of answers, because what he actually does is he has sort of anecdote and then theory and then anecdote. So, you know, he opens up with Cairo, moves on through London, goes to slums in the Philippines, to Greece, to Spain, you know, and puts in these different real-world examples that sort of at least partially answer, I think, a lot of the actual problems people are bringing up. Just the stuff that I don't think that's true. And the technological determinism, I wouldn't agree with Mark. I think he's deliberately technologically determinist, like consciously, and points out he is being. Because what he does is he talks about how the old factory system constructed not only the working class, but also the left and the unions, and how it created a particular left and a particular union movement. So his argument is definitely deliberately technologically determinist, in the sense of arguing that this new thing we're living under is actually having an effect on the way people think. Like, it's not just giving us a set of tools, it's actually transforming what people are from one form into another, just as the factory system previously did. And I mean, the idea that the factory system transforms what we are, it's pretty uncontroversial, really, you know, in terms of society. Like, we didn't necessarily really have any sort of understanding of time in the sense we have it now until we had to go through a particular set of gates at a particular time. And suddenly our entire life became structured around that, you know, and that took a generation at least to impose on people. And from that point of view, the arguments about whether the internet is good or bad, whether the information circulated is accurate or inaccurate, whether or not you can leak internal documents, any of those are all completely irrelevant. The thing is, this is something that has happened that is transforming the things, and we can't actually go back to the old box. We can't actually go back to that old left that was based on this particular industrial structure that previously existed. We might think it worked better, we might think it worked worse. He actually does a pretty good job of you know, saying, well, here are the pluses and here are the negatives. I mean, the negatives of that system was that it was also the system that you could create Stalinism either, because it was based on, you know, discipline, getting people to march in ranks, single slogans, all those sort of things as well. You know, that's he thinks it's harder with what's happening to people today, that sort of thing will become harder. Whether or not that's true is something for discussion. The issue of moving from online stuff to real-world stuff is actually one of the really interesting issues, because it's part of the story of what happened in 2011. Like, again, I was following the Egyptian stuff on Twitter, probably the same people. And I mean, part of that story is how social networks enabled the situation where a relatively small number of people were able to take advantage, for lack of a better term, of a developing situation and build that into much bigger things. But, I mean, he actually opens the book with talking about how one of the key moments was when the people who'd been doing stuff on Facebook and Twitter and were somewhat organised decided to go into the slums of Cairo and actually organise for people to march from there to the square rather than calling for people to come down to the square itself. You know, so it wasn't... He's definitely not arguing that all you need to do is put up a Facebook status update and everybody come out and riot. You just get 4 years for that or whatever. It's more the interaction. It's the interface of that interaction. And from that point of view, the fact that, you know, lots of people still don't have email and all that sort of stuff is also not so relevant. I mean, again, if you go back to the old factory system thing, I mean, huge numbers of people outside that system. There were just huge disadvantages to it. Like, it really privileged skilled white workers, right? Like, if you look at the union structures, they're the people who they revolved around. And in many cases, it protected them at the expense of other people. You know, it's not like that you can look at these things and say, oh, this is really straightforward, everything was good. There's always bad sides to it as well. And it's obviously true today that, you know, the people with privileges are the people who already have access, the people who have skills at this stuff, the people who, for one reason or another, are able to spend half their lives online. They're in a much better position than the person who doesn't have a computer and has to rely on somebody else to tell them what's going on. But one of the things I think that's useful in understanding why this... Why even if lots of people don't have access, it can still have a determining impact, is if you look back to the period of the early growth of republicanism, right, say even in Ireland, right, so the United Irishmen, right, so one of the key things everybody agrees that was important to them building the movement is the papers like the Northern Star and stuff like that, right? But if you look at literacy figures, they're only 5%. So only 5% of the people could actually read for themselves what was written. And in fact, part of the way those movements built was what that meant was if you wanted to know what was in the paper, you had to go to the cafe or the pub or whatever it was in the village. Some guy would read it out, and that actually then gave you a chance to discuss what was in it. So in a way, that was almost a plus.
Can I, just a quick question, right? Because I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking specifically about, say, the John Monaghan video. 90,000 people have seen that video, right? 90,000 people.
120,000.
No, 120. It's clicking up. Like, imagine a clock clicking above my head as we speak. But imagine if we had 120,000 people in Eris. You know what I mean? The difference is vast. So what I'm saying is that this knowledge exists, but it doesn't seem to be. Does he have a magic solution for when you get to the moment where you actually just go out onto the streets and you say, okay, we've had enough of this, now we're going to go down? Like, I mean, does those moments, do they not happen outside of technology anyway? That's what I'm saying. Like, so what's the relationship between those two?
I think that's the story, though, of 2011, because the story of 2011 is the story of how things moved from Facebook or Twitter or Blackberries into the streets of Egypt or Tunisia or even the London riots, if you think about it, right? That it was a story of how tools were used, you know, became used, and suddenly lots of people got involved because of what's happening. I mean, you're right, yeah, having 120,000 people looking at a video in itself it's somewhat useful. It couldn't have happened up to this point. Imagine trying to, like, you know, YouTube came into existence in 2005, I think. Like, it's really recent. So if you think about that, right, 10 years ago, there would be no possible way that could have happened. Absolutely, you know, you could have burnt it onto DVDs, but you couldn't have burnt 120,000 DVDs unless you were a multimillionaire. And how would you distribute them? It's completely impossible. But yes, the question, I mean, if you don't have the answer to that, I don't have the answer, but it's the right question to be asking. How do you turn that, you know, how do you turn your 120,000 passive views into people active? And I think the key point there is that the, and I think it's what happened in the examples we saw in 2011, that can be quite a sudden moment, which is not to say that people didn't spend quite a lot of time preparing for that sudden moment. But the actual turning point, and this is true of revolutions in general, if you look at them, I mean, you know, they don't necessarily build up over a very, very long period of time and slowly get bigger. But definitely today, it can be quite a sudden turn moment where people are going, oh, okay, this is actually happening now. You know, like in the Egyptian context, people talk about, you know, people suddenly losing their fear of the regime. You know, and that partly being due to when they actually turned the internet off. Because they were going, oh, now they're really scared. What the fuck's going on?
We'll have to go out and find out what's going on.
Yeah.
Greg, it's a really brief. I want to wrap this up, and I know Quiva's got a little AOB announcement for us as well.
No, it's okay. It's just okay,
Quiva, can you?
It's just flagging something that we've just started to prepare, but hopefully maybe for a week Saturday, we're trying to get a symbolic sort of demonstration outside of Saudi Embassy. Today is the 26th day of the hunger strike of a Bahraini activist called Abu Mahdi al-Khawaja. And the Bahraini movement in general has been extremely isolated, completely ignored in the Arab world. And the discourse, unfortunately, in much of the Arab world, amongst people who would have supported the movements in Tunisia and Egypt and many other countries, is a very sectarian one. And that has become increasingly more an element of sort of post-Arab Spring, in the sense that, at least in the Arab media, it's being claimed as an Islamist awakening, not just Islamic, but Islamist. And a lot of Islamist parties in the Arab world have reaped the political benefits of a lot of people's sacrifice. So I'd see Bahrain as one of the few movements that has actually remained sort of pretty clean, and in which political sort of opportunist parties haven't quite had the same possibility to move in on the limited gains, you know, that they have so far. But this guy, Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, used to live in Ireland. He used to work for Frontline Defenders, and is an incredible activist. I mean, he's just, his whole family, like his daughters, maybe you've seen her, Zainab Al-Khawaja, she sort of goes under this Twitter thing of the Angry Arabia, sort of a play on the Angry Arabs blog. But he is on his 26th day. He's been on a hunger strike previously for a couple of months. He's only taking water. He's not taking glucose or electrolytes or anything else. And he's already in a very precarious health situation. He was one of the people that was mentioned in the report that came out a couple of months ago, who was physically, psychologically, and sexually tortured in prison. So he's already pretty weak. But what we're thinking of doing, because there's no Bahraini embassy in Dublin, is doing it outside of the Saudi embassy, obviously to point to their total complicity in what's going on, and to try and mobilise people around his case, because it looks like this time he's pretty adamant that he wants to stick it out, and people around him are worried that he's not going to last, you know, excessively long. So that's something that we'll be putting word out about, and also on a more long-term basis, having spent a large part of my life in the Arab world and being very happy to be back here, I think the focus always has to be local, without a doubt, particularly now. But I think if there could be any international sort of issue in the Arab world that's being flagged up at the moment, it would be really great if there was solidarity with Bahrain. So there'll be that, and then we're hoping to do some sort of meeting in which we might have a link up with Zainab or members of our family, and maybe a couple of other speakers, just to sort of launch the idea of a solidarity group around Bahrain.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
You are listening to a Workers' Solidarity Movement podcast. You'll find more audio and articles from the Workers' Solidarity Movement at www.wsm.ie.